Barry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told, and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your
age. There you go.
And when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here, we're living now and we're all in this place. So be sure to smile.
Good afternoon. You're listening to
Go ahead.
The Enlightened Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. That was Stosh Zielkowski, and I am your co-host, Fanny Crawford. Today's Monday, July 9th, 2018, and it's 12 noon, so you must be listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour, community-based internet radio broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia. Hi, Stosh.
Hi. I got so excited to be sitting next to the microphone that I wanted to talk right away. No, I didn't know what I was going to say.
Do you have something you'd like to say right now?
I'm glad to be back.
Well, I'm glad we're both back. And our theme today is sports history. We have some interesting stories and some poetry to share with our audience today. So, do you want to start with Speak Story Series? That would be traditional.
There you go.
Most of the time, we do love tradition, don't we?
Yes. And we can jump right in for tomorrow, July 10th, at Reynolds Hall on the campus of Shepherd University at 7:30 p.m., Dovey Thomason, Native American, internationally known storyteller, will be presenting a program, How the West Was Spun. I guarantee that it will be a wonderful program. And you'll find out some things that you thought you knew and and didn't know. August 14th, Corrine Stavish will be there. And then in September 11th, Donald Davis. October 9th, Linda Gorham. November 13th, Megan Wells. And December 11th, Elizabeth Ellis.
And I'm really looking forward to every single one of those programs, but it will be wonderful to have Elizabeth back because she was snowed out back in March.
So. And that's going to be a wonderful lineup. And I'm looking forward to tomorrow because I had to miss the last one.
I always look forward to Dovey. In fact, I was thinking of inviting Dovey to Stories in the Round again because it's been, I think, 3 years.
That would be wonderful.
Since she was with us. So I'm hoping I get to ask her, pop the question when we see her tomorrow evening. Well, sports history. I want to start us out with a pretty famous poem, but I'm then going to add to that. So I will probably do this in two parts because the poem itself will probably take us to a station identification transition time. But this is Casey at the Bat by Ernest Lawrence Thayer. But then we're going to talk about the real story of Casey at the Bat. The outlook wasn't brilliant for the Mudville Nine that day. The score stood 4-2 with but one inning more to play. And then when Cooney died at first and Barrows did the same, a sickly silence fell upon the patrons of the game. A straggling few got up to go in deep despair. The rest clung to that hope which springs eternal in the human breast. They thought if only Casey could but get a whack at that, we'd put up even money now with Casey at the bat. But Flynn preceded Casey, as did also Jimmy Blake. And the former was a Lulu and the latter was a cake. So upon that stricken multitude, grim melancholy sat, for there seemed but little chance of Casey's getting to the bat. But Flynn let drive a single to the wonderment of all, and Blake, the much despised, tore the cover off the ball. And when the dust had lifted and the men saw what had occurred, there was Jimmy safe at second and Flynn a hugging third. Then from 5,000 throats and more, there rose a lusty yell. It rumbled through the valley. It rattled in the dell. It knocked upon the mountain and recoiled upon the flat. For Casey, mighty Casey, was advancing to the bat. There was ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. There was pride in Casey's bearing and a smile on Casey's face. And when, responding to the cheers, he lightly doffed his hat, no stranger in the crowd could doubt 'twas Casey at the bat. 10,000 eyes were on him as he rubbed his hands with dirt. 5,000 tongues applauded when he wiped them on his shirt. And then, while the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hip, defiance gleamed in Casey's eye. A sneer curled Casey's lip. And now the leather-covered sphere came hurtling through the air, and Casey stood a-watching it in haughty grandeur there. Close by the sturdy batsman, the ball unheeded sped. "That ain't my style," said Casey. "Strike one," the umpire said. From the benches black with people, there went up a muffled roar like the beating of the storm waves on a stern and distant shore. "Kill him! Kill the umpire!" shouted someone on the stand. And it's likely they'd have killed him had not Casey raised his hand. With a smile of Christian charity, great Casey's visage shone. He stilled the rising tumult. He bade the game go on. He signaled to the pitcher, and once more the spheroid flew. But Casey still ignored it, and the umpire said, "Strike two!" "Fraud!" cried the maddened thousands, and echo answered, "Fraud!" But one scornful look from Casey, and the audience was awed. They saw his face grow stern and cold. They saw his muscles strain, and they knew that Casey wouldn't let that ball go by again. The sneer is gone from Casey's lip. His teeth are clenched in hate. He pounds with cruel violence his bat upon the plate. And now the pitcher holds the ball, and now he lets it go. And now the air is shattered by the force of Casey's blow. Oh, somewhere in this favored land, the sun is shining bright. The band is playing somewhere, and somewhere hearts are light. And somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout. But there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out.
Such sadness in the stands.
Broken hearts.
Well done.
All around.
That was wonderful.
Thank you, Stosh.
And it seems shorter than I remember.
It does seem shorter, doesn't it? It was interminable the first time.
Right.
Everyone hears it. I do love that poem. My father introduced me to that poem. And according to my dad, Mudville was Philadelphia. Now, I have read something different in my research on the backstory of Casey at the Bat. So I'll share some of that later. But right now, I guess we need to say that you're listening to Enlighten Radio. Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org. And we are happy you're with us today, Monday, July 9th, 2018. Our theme today is sports history. And we have a number of really entertaining stories and poems and anecdotes and correcting the record.
Well, would you like to hear my story?
Yes, please.
Okay. This actually goes back... almost exactly 62 years.
Wow.
So the names will not be familiar to any children, probably. However, anyone who's ever followed baseball, even a little bit, will recognize some of the names in this story. And in 1956, the All-Star Game was held. The All-Star Game for the Major League Baseball was held in Washington, D.C. at Griffith Stadium. And I lived in Baltimore at the time. And the day before the game, on Wednesday, my uncle, Father Joe, a Catholic priest, my mother's brother, showed up at the house and had dinner with us. And after dinner, my dad and my uncle and I were sitting in the front room, and Uncle Joe said, "How would you like to go to the All-Star Baseball game tomorrow?" Well, I thought he was talking to my father. And he was, but he was also talking to me. And he explained that some parishioner, he was a priest in the Washington, D.C. area, and he often got gifts from parishioners, and he knew lots of the different special people in Washington, D.C. He knew a lot of politicians, and he knew a lot of athletes. And he said, "I have 3 tickets for the All-Star game, and I would like to take you 2 to the game." Well, I was thrilled, and my dad was too. My dad had been a baseball player when he was a young man, and I would love to have been a baseball player, and I played on some teams, but I wasn't very good at it. I was okay. I could make the team and got to play. But anyway, 1956, the All-Star Game. The next day, my father and I drove to Washington, picked up Uncle Joe, Father Joe, at his parish house, and went to Griffith Stadium. On the way, he said, there was one detail I forgot to tell you. I have 3 tickets, and 2 of them are together, and 1 is in a different section. And Uncle Joe was used to being, for those of you who are of the Catholic persuasion or know Catholics, 62 years ago, a Catholic priest was often in charge of whatever he wanted to be. So he said, "So I think what we should do is your father and I will sit together." And here, he handed me a ticket and a $20 bill. A $20 bill in 1956. And he said, "That's so if you want to get a soda or you want to get popcorn or something." And he said, "And I think you'll like where you're going to be seated." Well, we parked the car, got into the stadium, and they gave me a spot where to meet them after the game and made sure I remembered the number and place. And I wasn't all that dumb, but they wanted to make sure they didn't want to lose a teenager there, you know. I found my seat and couldn't believe it. I was on the first base side, 3 rows behind the American League dugout. When the players were getting ready for the game and warming up, I could see some of the faces as clearly as I could see them on the baseball cards that I collected. And some of the biggest stars of the game were playing that year. Well, I didn't spend all that $20 bill, but I did get a lot of popcorn and some sodas and had a great time. And for people who follow sports, some of the best ball players that ever played in the major leagues were in that game. One of them that everybody would know is Willie Mays, the Say Hey Kid, who wound up being the 2nd or 3rd most home runs hit by anybody in his major league career. and who perfected the basket catch deep in the outfield. A long flying ball, he would often cruise to the ball, and just before it would be caught, he would back up a little bit, put his glove out like a basket, and let the ball fall gently into it. Lots of little league and pony league and even high school players suffered the ire of their coaches when they tried to imitate Willie Mays, because in those days we were taught to catch the ball with two hands, your open glove and your other hand to cover it. Well, in the fourth inning, Willie Mays hit a gigantic home run. In the sixth inning, another name people would remember from those days, who also was in the one of the top home run hitters in all of baseball, a switch hitter, the New York Yankees, Mickey Mantle. Mantle hit a home run in the sixth inning. Two batters later, he was followed by one of the greatest hitters of all time, the last man to hit over 400 average for an entire season. Did that in 1941. That is an incredible record. 1941, that's 77 years ago. And no one has batted 400 for an entire season. The great Ted Williams. Ted Williams hit a home run. In the seventh inning, another one of the greatest ball players of that era, of any era, a man who had a wonderful name. His first name was Stanislaus, which just happens to be my first name. And I always liked him. In his playing days, he went by Stan the Man Musial. So, 1956 All-Star Game. The National League All-Stars beat the American League All-Stars 7-3, but the four of the greatest hitters in the history of baseball, Willie Mays, Ted Williams, Mickey Mantle, and Stan Musial, all blasted home runs.
What was the score again?
7-3.
Whoa.
And it was a great game. And I had a wonderful time. And I came home with $17.25 in my pocket. And when I asked Uncle Joe if he wanted the change, he said, no, that was for you. That's the most money I carried in my pocket, I think, until I was in the Army. And that's the 1956 All-Star Game with four of the greatest hitters that ever lived.
What a great story.
I can just see young Stosh there in the stands by himself, independent at last.
Yes. I got a couple of funny looks from there were no other young people in that area. I was the only teenager.
Those were the expensive seats.
Yes. I was so glad I didn't have to sit with Uncle Joe and my dad.
So he planned that out pretty. In fact, he might have purposely.
He might have done that. Yeah. My Uncle Joe liked me. Did lots of nice things for me throughout my life. So.
And a few weird ones.
Yes. But that's,
but that's another story.
A different story.
Okay. Well, I'm going to talk for a minute about no, I'm not. I'm going to talk for a few minutes about Stories in the Round.
Good.
The story series that I coordinate in Hagerstown, Maryland. That in July, our session is the fourth Monday, July 23rd. And our listeners may remember, since I've been talking about this for months, that we have Magid Melvin Medelitz, who wants to be billed as the Whispering Magid. A Magid, if you've never heard that word before, is a Hebrew word for a storyteller, a certified storyteller in the rabbinical or Judaic sacred tradition. And Melvin Medelitz will be with us at 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Hagerstown, 13245 Searfoss Pike, which is Salem Avenue Extended, just at the western edge of Hagerstown on that Monday evening, telling sacred stories. So I hope that people are able to join us. I've known Melvin Mendelitz my entire life. I spent the first 11 years of my life expecting to be in his sixth grade classroom at my elementary school, and was devastated when I was assigned to the other sixth grade teacher, Mr. Sweeney, who I did come to love in time and learned eventually that Mr. Mendelitz and Mr. Sweeney were good friends. At the time, Melvin Mendelitz was not a Magid. He was a sixth grade teacher and a political activist of sorts in various venues, peace and labor rights and social justice movements. Was at the March on Washington, worked for the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers on the executive board, but mostly he was a storyteller and beloved of elementary schools, students all over Philadelphia. But now, in retirement, he is a teller of sacred tales, and he's coming to Hagerstown on July 23rd to do just that. So if you want more information, you can contact me, Fanny Crawford, at 301-730-1638. You can email me at fanitsky, F-A-N-I-T-S-K-Y, at hotmail.com, or call that number, 301-730-1638. But any way you get there, please do come out to hear The Whispering Magid on July 23rd in Hagerstown.
I'm looking forward to that.
I think we have time for a short little story before. Well, I'll do the backstory for Casey at the Bat.
Well, you're the boss. I have some short things if you want.
Go ahead. Do a okay. short thing and then.
Well, here's a short thing to share. This is I played soccer for many years in 7th and 8th grade, and then through high school, in the Army, and then college, and even after college for a number of years. And I'm the same age, just about the same age, of a few months difference, of probably the greatest soccer player ever, goal scorer. And in 1958, at the age of 18, a man by the name of Edson Arantes do Nascimento scored a goal in the World Cup and helped Brazil to win the World Cup championship. His name was hard to remember, and he had a nickname that everybody who's ever heard of a soccer game or interested in would know it. His name is Pelé.
Even I know Pelé.
That's great. And so when I was in high school, I became aware of Pelé, and I started to follow his career. In after high school, I went into the Army, and while I was in the Army, I was able to find things, especially when I was stationed in Germany. I was able to get information about professional soccer and followed what Pelé and the Brazilian team that he played for was doing. And then, after college, the World Cup was played every 4 years. Pelé's team had won the World Cup in 58 and again in 62. In 66, they didn't. They didn't play in the finals. But in June of 1970, the Brazilian team and the Italian team went through the competition and were scheduled to meet on Sunday, June 21st, to play for the World Cup championship. No team had ever won the World Cup 3 times at that time. Both Italy and Brazil had won it twice. Well, it just so happened that June 21st was near Father's Day. And I decided that a Father's Day present for my dad, who had helped me to play soccer by encouraging me when I was in high school, when I was in college. He often would come to college games that were near Baltimore, and sometimes on weekends he would drive to games that I played in at a number of different places. And I bought tickets to go to the Civic Center in Baltimore, where they were going to project the final live action of the World Cup on a monstrous screen. I bought 4 tickets, one for me, one for my father, one for my brother, Tony, and one for Tony's son, who was 10 years old and had shown some interest in soccer. Well, we went to the Civic Center. We had great seats. We were in an upper level, so the screen wasn't blocked at all from us. So I felt sorry for people that were in a lower level because they had heads in front of them, and being short, I never liked that. So we could see everything clearly. Well, in the 14th minute of the game, Rivelino, an outside right for Pelé, for Brazil, lofted the ball clear across the penalty area, and Pelé stormed down the left side, leaped into the air, and drove it into the net and scored a goal. And the Civic Center in Baltimore went crazy. Baltimore has a very large Italian population, and I think then it was even a more serious Italian occupation as far as people, residents living there. And probably 3/4 of the Civic Center seats were taken by Italians. But there were a great many, I'm not sure if they were from Brazil or if they were just South American or Latin people. But when the ball hit the back of the net and Brazil took the lead, a bunch of men got up from their seats and formed a line and began a conga line and danced through the aisles. And without thinking, I got up and joined the line. It didn't last long, probably 3 or 4 minutes before ushers began to shush us and tell us to sit down and sit down, you know, because we were blocking people's views. And I remember so well the look on my father's face when I came back to my seat. And he just shook his head. And later when we got home and the game was over and Brazil had won in the World Cup, beating Italy 4-1. And my father said, "That is the most surprising thing you've ever done. And you've done some things that have really shocked me in my life." So I said, "I was surprised too, Pop, because I hadn't planned on doing anything like that, but I was swept up in the excitement and the happiness I felt for Pelé and the Brazilian team." That was the World Cup. And a little footnote, Pelé is the only soccer player who has ever played and won 3 World Cups.
Ah, that's great record.
That is an incredible record. And now, and Brazil is the team who has won the most World Cup championships. They've won 5 now. June 1970.
wonderful story.
I think it's time for some information about what you're listening to. You're listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org, broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, with your co-host, myself, Stasz Jokowski, and
Fanny Crawford.
And today we're talking about sports
history.
And Fanny is going to follow up my the stories I've been telling have been very personal, but Fanny's going to follow up and about her first story that she told, Casey at the Bat, with some information about the real Casey.
Okay, so I already told you when I recited that poem that it was written by Ernest Lawrence Thayer, who was a journalist born into a well-to-do family and went to Harvard. And while he was there, he, what is the name of the student newspaper at Harvard? The one that's so famous for humor and just flew out of my head. It'll come to me. But anyway, he was editor of the paper for a while. And while there, oh, these names have just flown out of my head. The film Rosebud is in, The Sled. What's the name of the journalist and newspaper owner? The famous...
Wells.
Yeah, that's the actor, Orson Welles. But the publisher is William...
Okay. Hearst.
Thank you.
Randolph Hearst. William Randolph Hearst.
William Randolph Hearst. Did not bring enough notes with me, obviously, for the holes in my head. But Ernest Lawrence Thayer became good friends with William Randolph Hearst and eventually went to work for Hearst when Hearst began managing the San Francisco newspaper. And at the same time that Mark Twain and Ring Lardner and, oh, there's another famous name, Jack London, all worked for the newspaper at about that time. So Ernest Lawrence Thayer worked there for years doing a number of different things, but he's most famous for what they called ballads, so poems that he would add to the newspaper every week. And his swan song, when he finally left the newspaper, his last poem was Casey at the Bat. And it was a bit popular at the beginning, but then it sort of languished, went, just kind of disappeared. No one remembered it. None of the poems that he wrote were earth-shattering or wildly popular poems. But he was a well-respected journalist and writer. But then, onto the national stage, stepped a man named George Joseph Moriarty, who was an American baseball player, a third baseman. He was also an umpire and a manager in Major League Baseball later in his life. From 1903 into the 40s, played for the Chicago Cubs, for a New York team named the Highlanders, Detroit Tigers, and the White Sox in Chicago in the teens from about 1900 up till about 1916, 1917. And he claimed to be the baseball player that poem that Casey at the Bat was written about. It is standard American lore that Casey at the Bat was a story, was a myth, a folklore piece that was in circulation before Thayer wrote the poem down or created the poem out of that story. But one of the things that I heard as a child was that the team was from Philadelphia or was playing for Philadelphia, and that incident actually happened there. And that I did not find that anywhere in the research that I did. But Philadelphia apparently does claim it, and my dad used to repeat that story about it being in Philadelphia. But Moriarty, in addition to being a baseball player, also did some vaudeville and used that poem when he was on the stage performing in vaudeville. He was born in Chicago, grew up near the Union Stockyards, made his major league debut in 1903 when he was just 19 with the Chicago Cubs. He was just an average hitter, but he was an outstanding base runner and was famous for stealing bases. 8 consecutive seasons, 248 career stolen bases, including 11 times stealing home, which must be some kind of a record. He played his last major league game in 1916 with the White Sox. But there's so many of these little tidbits about this guy. He was quite a character. Hank Greenberg played with the Tigers, and in the 1935 World Series was one of the famous times when Greenberg got a lot of anti-Semitic shouts and shout-outs, slurs from the stands. And Moriarty at that time was an official. He was no longer playing, of course, because he last played in 1916. But when he couldn't get the players to stop, he gave several warnings and yanked a couple people from the bench. But when that didn't work and those abuses kept up during the World Series, he cleared the entire Chicago bench. He just threw all of them out of the game. And that got him fined and almost fired by Commissioner Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who is famous in the game, in baseball history, for working really hard, longer than anybody else, to keep African Americans out of the major leagues throughout the 25 years that Landis was in office as commissioner. And Moriarty also supported Greenberg through the 1938 season, keeping the game going into darkness when Greenberg was able to finish with 58 homers, just too shy of Babe Ruth's record. So Greenberg owes a lot to Moriarty. And I have a quote here from Hank Greenberg. "Much later in my career, George Moriarty and I became very good friends. Back in the early 1900s, he played third base for Detroit, and he used to steal home. Somebody wrote a poem about him, and the title was Never Die on Third Moriarty. And all through the rest of his life, George felt he knew something about stealing home. Whenever he was umpiring on third base, and I'd get to third, he'd coach me how to take a lead so I could steal home. But I never had the guts to try," Hank Greenberg said, "because I didn't think I could make it. I'd run down the line, and he'd keep insisting I take a bigger lead. But I was always afraid I was going to get picked off. It was so interesting to me to see Moriarty, who was umpire at third base, coaching me how to steal home for the Tigers." It was a big joke among the players, but I never got up the nerve to try it. That's Hank Greenberg reporting on his friendship with George Moriarty, who is reputed to be the baseball player that Casey at the Bat was written about. Okay.
George Moriarty.
Yes.
That's a famous name.
Yes, it is. There's an actor named Michael Moriarty who is apparently related to George. Mm.
I was thinking of the infamous Moriarty.
Moriarty, yes, from Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes.
Probably much more famous than Michael Moriarty.
Never know.
And George.
That was interesting. I didn't know that. And I've always liked Casey at the Bat very much. So, do you have another for us?
I do. I have a little piece about John Wooden.
John Wooden, who won 10 national championships.
Yeah, for basketball.
At UCLA.
Yeah.
A really great coach.
You looked stunned when I said that. Well, we are shifting gears, going from baseball and
soccer.
That's
okay.
Okay.
That's wonderful. I loved John Wooden. I thought he was a great example for anybody who wanted to be a coach.
Yes.
You know, because he really coached a lot of different kinds of people.
Well, he's one of those characters who... probably no matter what he did in life, he would have become famous because he was so eclectic and so good at finding messages and wisdom
right.
in totally unrelated
right.
topics. And I did read John Wooden's autobiography several years ago, mm. which was a stretch for me because I don't read a lot of sports history. what I do read tends to be connected to other things in my life. So I did read his autobiography, and I was impressed by all of the players who clearly loved him, even though he might have given them a very hard time mm-hmm. when they were coming up. But what I found out just recently was that he was solicited by Poetry Magazine several years ago to write about the uses of poetry in Big Ten basketball. Hmm. And I just found that just amazing. So John Wooden apparently learned at his father's knee poetry of great American and great British poets because his dad read to him by the light of a coal oil lamp every evening after dinner when evening chores were finished on their Indiana farm. So this is a family of about routines and doing the right thing. And he was raised, John Wooden was raised by a man who respected literature. So as a child, he memorized Tennyson and Whitman and Longfellow, Whittier, James Whitcomb Riley, and Shakespeare. Oh. And he was able to quote them to basketball players for the rest of his life. He says that playing basketball at Martinsville High School in Indiana and later at Muncie Central High School, his coach, Coach Glenn Old Fox Curtis, would jump up on a bench. He was famous for jumping up on the bench at during a tough game. And this particular incident he's speaking of, that they had a very gloomy halftime break. And in Old Fox Curtis's fire and brimstone voice, he proceeded to light a fire under those teenage players, ending with, "For when the one great scorer comes to mark against your name, he writes not that you won or lost, but how you played the game." And I never knew where that phrase come from. It's not how you win, whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game. But that apparently is the poem that it came from. And Wooden then goes on to say that his team, the Muncie Artisans, lost that game. But he's proud to say, "We lost, but we did not quit. We played a hard game. And we're proud of our tenacious effort. The poem worked its magic, and Wooden used it many times when he was coach, along with another piece by the poet George Moriarty." "Who can ask more of a man than giving all within his span? Giving all, it seems to me, is not so far from victory." I do love reading John Wooden because he always sounds like he's speaking for posterity, like right. he's waiting yeah. for people in the stands to be writing down his words. other quotes from Wooden. He's famous for starting each season at the first team practice with precise and meticulous demonstrations on how to put on your socks, how to lace and double tie your laces, to Wooden's exact specifications, always closing with the words, "Little things make big things happen." And then there's a quote that I've heard credited to Ben Franklin and Winston Churchill, but I think Wooden probably has made it popular these days. He took Bill Walton, that basketball hero, aside one day when the coach thought Walton was not giving the practice his best effort. And of course, Walton was UCLA's popular center with two undefeated seasons and two national championships. But Wooden gave it his best disappointed coach voice. "Failing to prepare is preparing to fail, Bill." And a little later, Walton, chastised by Wooden about something else and forbidden to return to practice till he'd cut his hair and shaved his beard, snapped back, quoting his favorite poet, Coach Wooden, "The times, they are a-changin'." For you young people out there, that's Bob Dylan. But Bill Walton quotes Coach Wooden all the time and quotes him to his own children, and was apparently known to write on brown paper lunch bags when he packed his kids' lunches. He would write down Wooden quotes for them. And he says his kids reacted about the same way that Bill himself reacted when he was hearing directly from the coach. But he hopes that a few of those words stick with his kids. And then this article that Wooden wrote for Poetry Magazine ends with his own words. "Talent is God-given, be humble. Fame is man-given, be thankful. Conceit is self-given, be careful."
Great. I followed John Wooden a lot, and the thing that impressed me about his coaching is he had players, some players who just followed him religiously and didn't ever
talk back.
Coach Brown. But I believe that the finish of that story about Walton's hair, Walton did cut his hair.
Oh, yeah.
And I heard Walton speak years later about how he realized afterwards that the hair business was nonsense, because he wasn't there to be doing a lot of the other stuff he was actually doing. He was there to play basketball and to learn from John Wooden. And Walton's son is a professional basketball player today.
Yeah, I think I heard that.
Yes. And I just always admired Wooden, because there was a time when there were a number of articles in a paper about, oh, what will he do with this crew?
Yeah, yeah.
They were, you know, as time went on, there were so many different things. And one thing I remember about Wooden near the end of his, after he had stopped coaching, but he went to the national meetings all the time at the during the NCAA tournament,
mm-hmm.
what they call the Final Four now, and there, because there was always a meeting of the national coaches and things, his wife always accompanied him. And when his wife died, shortly after that, he stopped attending those. And I read that the reason he stopped was because he had a terrible time with names. So many coaches knew him. He was so famous throughout the country. And he would go to these large meetings, and people would come up and talk to him, and he would be embarrassed if he didn't know who they were. And there was an anecdote in this thing that said his wife would stay with him when they were going to these things, and she would say, "This is Harry. He coaches at Temple." And John. And right away, he knew all about
who he
as
was.
A coach.
Right.
And that he just couldn't remember the name, you mm-hmm. know? So I thought that was nice because he in an article I read about him speaking about his wife, he obviously adored his wife and counted on her to help him out in different ways. So
good partnership.
Yes.
Well, I should probably do a station ID. You're listening yes. to the Enlightened Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org. I am Fanny Crawford, your co-host.
And I'm Stasi Olkowski.
Your other co-host. And we are enjoying our program today about sports history, some of it personal history, and yes. some of it researched or heard second, third, and fourth hands from other people. I was a volleyball player in high school, and my coach kept trying to get me to play basketball because that was really what Overbrook High School in Philadelphia was known for, girls' basketball and, of course, boys' basketball. I did play a couple pickup games, but it was way too scary for me. I grew up playing volleyball at summer camp, but I knew nothing at all about basketball. Even my dad, who was a sports fan insofar as he thought it necessary to know enough about sports to be able to talk to anybody on the street about sports. Wow. He could talk football and baseball. But I never heard him talk about basketball, and I know he didn't play basketball. So it was always just a bit too alien for me. I didn't want to play a game I couldn't be really good at.
Oh.
I was not willing to go out and make a fool of myself, and I knew nothing about basketball. So I couldn't even dribble, really. Yeah. I mean, I could fake it, but that wasn't good enough for me. So I stuck to basketball, and sometimes I played softball and worked on my pitching arm. When my daughter was playing softball, I pitched for her. I never pitched anywhere near a whole game, but blew my arm out.
Oh my goodness.
Trying to pitch for her. But I did work at that. Volleyball was really my favorite sport.
Well,
go ahead.
I shared with you two stories that were both happy. Dancing in the aisles, having $20 in my pocket to buy things at a baseball game. I have a short story that isn't happy.
Uh-oh, we're going to end on a down note.
Not necessarily down, but this is another personal story. In 1954, the St. Louis Browns became the Baltimore Orioles. The Baltimore Orioles had been a famous International League baseball team, but that was a minor league. And they had won a number of minor league championships and things, but they were not a major league baseball team. In 1954, the owners bought the St. Louis Browns and changed their name to the Baltimore Orioles. And April 15th, which was a Thursday, I was an eighth grader, and I was a member of the Curtis Bay Marching Band. Curtis Bay Marching Band was directed by Mr. Rosso, who was my accordion teacher. He was a music teacher. And I was in the marching band. And we were in the parade, a 90-minute parade for the first Orioles for this game. They had played their first game 2 days before at another place. This day they were going to play the Chicago White Sox in Memorial Stadium on 33rd Street in Baltimore. Well, I was really excited about it when I found out that we were going to be marching in that parade. My brother was in the band also, and I don't think his school was off, but he took off school to be in the parade. And it was an exciting game. Two of the pitchers that were with the Orioles then, Bob Turley, Bullet Bob, and Don Larson, who became famous for pitching the first perfect game in the World Series, and that was in the 1960s when he was with the Yankees. Turley also wound up being with the Yankees. I remember that there was a home run hit by Clint Courtney, and I got to hear that home run being hit over the radio because my mother had decided that my brother, who was in high school, was old enough to go to the game. Our band director had gotten us tickets in the outfield, but that I was not old enough to go to the game. So the parade was 90 minutes long. I carried the cymbals 90 minutes. Did not like playing the cymbals. And it was drizzling, a very light drizzle, during much of the parade. And at the end of the parade, I had to get on a bus and go home while my brother got to go to the baseball game. And I was mad as a hornet at my mother and at my brother and even at the Orioles because I didn't get to go to the game. But I always remember Clint Scrap Iron Courtney, who was the catcher for the Orioles. He hit the first home run ever by an Oriole player in Memorial Stadium and was given a special, I believe it was a diamond ring, by the Orioles organization. So that's my story. I was a petulant little child.
I can understand why. That's a great disappointment.
Oh, boy.
It'd be one thing if you just didn't get to go, but your brother got to go.
I know. And, the big guy.
Well, we hope to have you join us next week, listeners, for the show on today's the 9th, so next week. Next.
16th?
Must be the 16th.
if we're still using the Roman calendar.
Yeah. So I hope everyone has a good week and you maybe think about sports history and think about us while you're out there. We'll be back next Monday at 12 noon. But of course, we want you to go to the podcasts at talltales.enlightenradio.org. Did you give this website for Speak Story Series?
I didn't.
Would you like to do that now?
SpeakStoryseries.com.
Yes, thank you. And if you want information about Stories in the Round, you can call me, Fanny Crawford, at 301-730-1638, or check with me via email at fanitsky@hotmail.com. We're going to close out the show, I think.
Yes.
Since I opened, Stosh, I think that's your job today.
Okay. This is Stosh Siolkowski and
Fanny Crawford,
your co-host for the Noontime Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org, independent community radio in Bolivar, West Virginia, closing out this week's show. The Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional storytellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to Bob Dylan.
Woohoo!
Thank you.